Okay.
Yeah.
Mr. Basrio 5. And did you get much time off when you were in Hong Kong? Were you able to go and see Hong Kong?
Yes. The shift pattern that we were working was 2 consecutive morning shifts. So if you were on morning shift, you were on from 7 until 3. So you would always have the evenings of those 2 days free. Then those 2 consecutive morning shifts were followed by 2 consecutive evening shifts. So then you had the morning free, but you were working in the evening. Then you were, those were followed by 2 complete days off. So you had time there, but on the second day off, you then began a night shift. So quite often you would want to have a little sleep before going on night shift. And you'd have these 2 consecutive night shifts. So in between those, you would spend a day catching up on your sleep back at camp. Then on the after the second night shift, well, it depended. If you really wanted to do something, you would fight the fatigue to do it. But if not, you would catch up on your sleep. But then you would have your evening off followed by 2 days off. So it was a pattern that went to 4 days you were working, and then you had 2 days off, and then 2 nights you were working, and then you had 2 days off. So it, on the whole, it seemed to give you a lot of free time. And when I came back to England after my first tour in 1954, and I came back to England to begin studying Mandarin at the School of Oriental and African Studies, I then met my wife, to-be, and she was working at SOAS. She was working in the... she was the assistant accountant on the staff. And eventually when we married, she then came out to Hong Kong with me. So on my second tour, we were living in married quarters. And the married quarters that were provided were quite a mixture. There were some that were regular blocks of flats that had been taken over as service married quarters. And then there were other married quarters where people were given an allowance to pay the rent in rented accommodation, which might be temporary, perhaps in a hotel or something. But the married quarters that we were in were very good. They 3 bedrooms, one with an ensuite bathroom, a large lounge area which had one complete wall was glass folding doors. Open those out onto a balcony which overlooked the sea directly. These were situated at an area called North Point, and so we were overlooking the harbour. So it was very pleasant. Initially, I suppose it had been part of a hotel block, but they had been utilised by the services as married quarters. And downstairs on the ground floor, you could go out into a shopping area where there were shops, restaurants. So if you didn't want to eat at home, you'd got restaurants on your doorstep.
In that first tour, what sort of things would you do with your spare time in Hong Kong?
I was fortunate in as much as initially when we arrived in Hong Kong, the Air Force decided that to continue our Chinese instruction, they would employ a Chinese language teacher. Unfortunately, he wasn't Cantonese. He came from further north, so he spoke with he spoke Cantonese with a northern accent, shall I say. But he was teaching us, continuing our Chinese instruction in a basic way. He was a very friendly fellow, and he, because there were only four of us doing Cantonese, he invited us to go and have a meal with his family. Although he was a bachelor, but his family was quite an extended family. He got cousins and uncles and aunts and goodness knows what. And so we had this meal amongst all these Chinese people and that. But soon after that, he introduced me to two of his cousins who were still at school who wanted to improve their English. So I was able to go along on my time off and teach, well, it wasn't so much teach them English, but encourage their English. And we did this through reading. Well, I found the Reader's Digest in those days very useful as an aid because it had short articles and illustrations. It was a colourful publication. It had little pithy pieces that, you know, you could go through fairly quickly. And also help them in the language that they were learning at school with any questions they got. And so I became part of their family in a way. I used to be invited along on occasions, quite often in fact. And because they were part of a large family with all age range, there were some little children again, and I quite often spoke to these children. And because my name is Bass, in Hong Kong, the Chinese call a bus a Basi. So they called me Basi because that was, it was their joke. So I played along with them. So whenever I was visiting them and the little children would ask if I wanted a drink, I would say yes. And they'd bring me a glass of tea, which I would then say that, the bus likes to drink petrol, you see. And that would send them off, you know, in fits of laughter. And but we we would get on quite well with sort of simple childish jokes. But it caught me out on one occasion when one of the little boys had got a picture book, and I thought, well, this is a good chance to extend my vocabulary. So we went through the picture book and I was asking him, what's this called, you know, I'm pointing to things like a lion or a tiger or whatever. It came to a picture, there was a penguin. So I said, what's this called? Jerkjai, he said. So I thought, Jerkjai. I'm one over on my colleagues at camp because I now know the Cantonese for penguin, Jerkjai. Trouble was, he didn't know, the little boy didn't know what a penguin was, and he told me it was a dicky bird. So there was I thinking, you know, that I knew Cantonese for penguin when really I was telling people I'd seen a dicky bird at the zoo. So one has to be careful. But it was through them that I had an introduction to a lot of their friends. And so we used to go out for beach picnics, swimming. Part of the family had got a farm out in the New Territories, which is the rural side of Hong Kong life, and get invited out for a weekend or something to go and spend a day or a couple of days on their farm. And when I say farm, nothing like an English farm. There were no animals. It was purely sort of vegetables I don't think they even had fish ponds, although there are a lot of fish ponds and of course paddy fields and things like that in the new territories. But theirs was more basic vegetables. But it was a good way to have a break away from busy traffic in the town and that, and get out into the country. And also talking with young Chinese, some of them still at school, but more or less contemporary, in that I was in my late teens, early 20s, they were in their mid-teens, most of them. But it opened my eyes when on one occasion they said they were going to invite me out for a picnic. And when you hear a word like picnic, certain images come to mind. But the Chinese, when I turned up, had got their cooking pots and all the paraphernalia for making a campfire, and boil water, and they boiled rice. My friend said, we Chinese, we can't do... it's not a meal unless you have rice. So for me, a Chinese picnic was much more than cakes and sandwiches. It was a real cooked meal out in the open. That was good.
Did you have like a period of leave while you were your first
time? Well, we could take leave. I think one of the places where most people went, if they wanted to get out of Hong Kong for a period of leave, the easiest thing to do was to go and spend time in Macau, which was the Portuguese colony on the other side of the Pearl River estuary. So whereas Hong Kong was a British colony, Macau was a Portuguese colony. But the local Chinese in both places spoke Cantonese, and so going to Macau was an easy step for a Cantonese speaker, but whereas in Hong Kong you saw English alongside the Chinese, in Macau it was all Portuguese alongside the Chinese. Of course, those days are long since gone, because now both Hong Kong and Macau are part of China.
So did you go to Macau?
I did, yes. Yes, I went for a weekend. I think the RAF hockey team were playing a team in Macau, and they got a few spare places. And so a few colleagues and I, we went along. We didn't go along to watch the hockey. We weren't interested in watching the sport. We went because it was an opportunity to see Macau and see a new place, which I appreciated. It was quite a good experience. It was quite different. Compared with Hong Kong, Macau seemed to be a very sleepy, run-down place. There were far more bicycles and rickshaws, rather than cars and buses. There were no trams. Hong Kong, of course, is noted for its trams. Trams that in Hong Kong you could take a tram ride from along the north shore of the island. You could go from one end to the other for a fixed fare of 20 cents, which in those days was just a few pence. And there were double-decker trams, so if you went on the upper deck you had a good grandstand view of all the streets they went through. And it was good practice, actually, for looking at the shop signs and trying to read the characters. You could also tell roughly where you were in Hong Kong. Even a blind person on a tram, I suppose, could tell whereabouts they were, because starting at one end, at the terminus in Sau Kee Wan, you had this pungent smell of rubber. There was a rubber factory there. So that was Sau Kee Wan and its smell of rubber. You then went on through an area called Wan Chai, where there are a lot of furniture making shops, and you smelt the varnish. And then down at the eastern end of the island, the western end, I'm sorry, yes, down at the western end of the island, you came to the fish markets. And a fish market at the height of summer, a height of a tropical summer, you can't mistake. So, as I say, a blind person would know roughly where they were by the smells. Also, the trams, they were fairly slow, so it gave you time to take in the scenery and to read shop signs as you passed, and to see life going on around you. And although the trams were fairly slow, they were very frequent, because it was a loop system. The tram lines ran along from one end to the other and turned around and ran all the way back. And so the trams were following along in convoy almost nose to tail. I mean, it was a question that a tram would come up to a stop if it was the rush hour. You know, crowds of people getting on. Didn't matter if you couldn't get on. The next tram is just waiting behind it. So pile on there. So a very frequent transport system, and very cheap. It was a great way of getting around. If you were in a hurry and you really wanted to get somewhere, and you thought you'd better take a taxi, even the taxis themselves in those days were very cheap, only equivalent of a few bob. And so again, it was... it was a good place to get around easily. The other, talking of transport, the other system was that from the peninsula in Kowloon, you could take a train on the Kowloon Canton Railway system, but it only went as far as the border, which was 22 miles of track. So you could only go up to 22 miles of track, and you couldn't even get to the real border. You got to a border zone where beyond that was prohibited, and it was only people with special passes that could go through, diplomats and Chinese with the right papers to cross the border into China and perhaps come back out of China again. And this happened a lot at the Chinese New Year festival, so there'd be a lot of people coming and going to visit relatives one side of the border or another. But the trains themselves, they were quite frequent, and in the early 1950s, of course, they were steam driven trains, and then they changed over to diesel. And of course, perhaps the most well-known form of transport is crossing the harbour on the ferries. The shortest distance between Hong Kong Island and Kowloon is only about a mile, and the ferry service that operates across that is the Star Ferry, and again, the ferries themselves were double deckers. Upstairs it was 20 cents, downstairs it was 10 cents. Most people travelled on the upper decks for 20 cents, and the people downstairs would be the labourers, the coolies, the ones transporting large bundles on the ends of bamboo poles, that sort of thing. But again, there are two piers, so that gave, well, that gave, there are two arms, shall I say, so that gave four piers, and on both sides, so you could have a maximum of eight ferry boats all crossing at one time. So again, they did say that they transported about 250,000 people every day on that ferry system just crossing the harbour. I can remember when I was in my second tour working. By then I'd left the Air Force, but I'd gone back. That's another story. But a colleague came and he posed a question to which I didn't have an answer, because he saw all these people crossing the harbour on these ferry boats, and he says, why do people cross the harbour to work? Why don't they work where they live? Which is a good question. But now, as I say, when I came back on my second tour, after coming back on my second tour to Hong Kong, where I now, having been trained in Cantonese, I had now been trained in Mandarin, so I had both languages to utilize. And I was married. My wife and I became interested in the work at a leprosy hospital, which was out on one of the outlying islands, a place called Heilongjiang. And we used to go there quite frequently as visitors, and we got to know quite a number of the staff as friends. And as they were working on an island, we gave hospitality for a number of them when they wanted to have a weekend break. So they came to stay with us in Hong Kong. And gradually, over time, my wife and I both felt that this was something that we would want to do when we left the Air Force, because at that time discussions were going ahead about civilianization, and they were offering options. Well, the two main options were that the linguists could transfer to GCHQ in Cheltenham, or to the Australian equivalent in Melbourne, and some of my colleagues did. I was still in touch with some of my colleagues who went to Melbourne, but I didn't feel that I really wanted to stay on in the Air Force at that stage. And having become interested in the work at the leprosy hospital, and also because I was very much wanting to do something in Hong Kong, to stay on in Hong Kong, I brought myself out of the Air Force, and we were accepted for service with the leprosy mission, and we went back to Hong Kong. And so after having spent some 10 years in the Air Force in Hong Kong, I then went on to spend another 12 years working with the leprosy mission in Hong Kong. Which, as I say, is another story. Mm. But
originally you left Hong Kong in 1954, at the end of your first tour.
Yes.
How did you get back to the UK?
It was... came back by plane. I was trying to remember. I can't remember what type of planes they were flying then. It was still RAF Transport Command, and I think it may have been on a Britannia. They were still four-engined, prop-driven planes. But it was a much quicker journey than the one going out. We didn't have to keep stopping at staging posts on the way. Planes were flying further without having the need to refuel, and the stops were fewer. So that was quite a quick journey coming back.
And then you were stationed, you returned to RAF Uxbridge, did you?
We did. I was stationed at RAF Uxbridge once more. But this time, by now, I had gone from, you know, starting off initially on my entrance into the RAF as a as an aircraftman, and then going up a leading aircraftman, LAC, SAC, a junior technician, a corporal technician. By that time, for my second second tour, I had then been promoted to sergeant. So the accommodation at RAF Uxbridge was in were single rooms in solid blocks. Very good accommodation in that in that respect.
Did being a sergeant mean you had extra duties as well?
Not particularly, no. We're still very much students. Going daily to the same, the system was the same, going up daily on the underground from Uxbridge to Russell Square, wearing civilian clothes, going into SOAS as students, learning Mandarin this time, going home in the evening, going back to camp in the evening, and just well, getting down to any study. But there weren't any duties as such that we were drawn into, any RAF duties. So it was what we used to call a cushy number.
Well, did this Mandarin course differ much from the Cantonese course you'd undertaken before?
No, it didn't differ much. It was basically spoken Mandarin, written Chinese. Covering a Chinese Mandarin Chinese course that I imagine would be given to anyone wanting to learn Chinese as a civilian. We did it on the course, although the majority of us were RAF personnel. We did rub shoulders with one or two students who were there to learn Chinese because of future diplomatic service. One was an Anglican priest learning Chinese, but they, of course, were in the minority. It was predominantly service personnel.
Did you have the same teachers again? Or?
No, the teachers changed. We knew the teachers that we had met previously, of course. They were still there, some of them, but we were having new teachers because the language was different. There were people who were specifically instructing us in Mandarin. Well, there are names. I don't know whether some of these people are still alive, or they will have retired anyway. But people like Dr. Cyril Birch and Malmquist. I remember the lovely name Malmquist. I think from Sweden. The head of Chinese at SOAS was Professor Simon, whose father had been instrumental in the Chinese courses, and he I know he was W. Simon, Professor of Chinese at the University of London. He was the one who had written the Chinese dictionary. So By the time we were doing Mandarin, it was his son, Harry Simon, who was in charge of Chinese courses. We got on quite well with him. He did a lot of travelling, and at that time, I think it was at the time when, although from the point of view of travel, China was still a closed country, it was very, very difficult to get into China. I mean, there were no package tours and things like that. But trade missions were beginning to go to China. And I can remember on one occasion going up in the lift at SOAS and overhearing a conversation between Harry Simon's wife and another member of staff. Someone said, "Oh, and how's Harry?" "Oh, he's fine. Yes, he's loving Peking." And so he'd gone off with a trade mission as an interpreter for him. So that was the first time I'm beginning to realise that China was beginning to open the door. And of course, by the time I left,